Today's date is the last day of February, the 29th of February 1996. This is Angus MacLeod, Mary Mac speaking. This is tape 3 that we are beginning here. And we are continuing from tape 2, where we started to comment on telegrams. And we had noted that on 28 June 1872, the SS La Plata, LA-PLATA, commenced to lay a cable across the Minch from Stornoway to Lochue at 1 o'clock, and by 6:30 p.m., the following message was transmitted to Donald Monroe, Town Chamberlain, Stornoway. The message reading as follows: I have much pleasure in informing you that the cable connecting the Western Hebrides with the mainland has been successfully completed today. On the last Monday of August 1872, the telegraph office at Stornoway opened to the public. The Stornoway cable laid by the SS La Plata in 1872 remained in service until it was replaced in 1933 by a telephone cable. Telegraphic communications came to Lochs on the 4th of November 1896, when the ABC system of communications was installed at Crosspost. Then in Balalan, Cowes and Grammar. The commencing allowance for indoor telegraph work and responsibility was one old penny a message, or 20 new pence weekly minimum. And the allowance for delivery, and I'm now talking about the delivery, young people, boys, I went around delivering these telegrams on the ABC system, which was not a Morse code, but something after that time of type of thing. if you could find an illustration or a picture of the ABC telegraphic machine as used in Lewes at that time, and used everywhere at that time, it would really be very good. We now go on to the telephones. The new trunk telephone service between Lewes and the mainland was inaugurated on Thursday, 21st March 1933. Well, we have already referred to the cable that was laid in 1933. The inauguration service was held in the Town Council Chamber, Stornoway, Provost Alexander MacLenna, a man from Marwick Loth, presided, and there were other members of the Town Council and other public bodies, including Mr. H. MacLean, postmaster, and officials from the post office. Provost MacLennan said it was a great day for Stornoway and Lewes because from then onwards it would be possible to speak from Stornoway to the mainland and even to such distant places as Australia. He then called on Mr. H. MacLean, the postmaster, to address the meeting. Mr. MacLean said that for many years the telegraph service between Lewes and the mainland has suffered suffered frequent interruptions, mainly due to damage by trawlers operating in the Minch. By a curious coincidence, these interruptions very often synchronized with the fishing seasons, a time when such failure of communication caused considerable inconvenience and loss, especially to the operators of the fishing industry, and so it became imperative to consider the provision of some more reliable and more adequate means of communication. There were telephones in all the post offices in Louis from early in the 20th century. The post office in North and South Locks, which was served by the ABC telegraph system except the post office in North and South Locks, which was served with the ABC system. Until 1933. Chrissy, as far as Locks, Northport, North and South was concerned, the telephone only came in 1933. In 1929, there were less than 20 telephone subscribers in the town of Stornoway, and there were none outside Stornoway in 1929. So various bodies were calling for these facilities, telegraph and telephone, and mainly in connection with the fishing and the Crofter Commission, the Napier Commission, and all these people calling for better communication. But then again, you see, I want to put that in the proper context. In 1933, when the telephone came, I had already left school 3 years before that, which I left in 1930. So that gives you an idea. And in 1929, when there was no telephones in rural Louisiana, and only 20 in Stornoway, a lot of the houses now have more than one telephone in each house. So that's the way things have changed. Certainly a telephone in almost every house. Now, Chrissy, I want to turn on to electricity and lamps and paraffin lamps. An old mantelpiece in front of me here just now is a Crucy lamp. One beige, there's fish oil, you see, used in the Crucy lamp. So probably your local people will tell you a lot about Crucy lamps. That was the earlier lamp we had. Then we went on to the paraffin. Well, that's what we had in our younger days, paraffin lamps, various kinds of shivakan lamps. And then we went on to the Tilly lamp. That really was a big improvement. And all that. So I think that's an easy one for yourself. About 1950, the hydroelectric board connected the electric supply to the villages of Park. So I take it it's around then that North Loch was connected as well. Now, I don't know what happened in your village, but the electric supply was joined to 18 houses in Carlbald. 18 houses. Now, you'll remember, in 1950, you remember that there's only 14 crofts in Carlbald and all. So that means that there was four houses more than the crofts was in Carlbald. So Carlbald was overcrowded even in 1950. After the Second World War. And that included every house except one in Carlbald. Among the houses that were joined to the electric supply were two thatched dwelling houses. Now that's the point I want to make, you see. I should think that possibly the thatched house, which I told you I have a picture of in Varnish, over at Loch Erisert direction, they probably had a very nice house it was, and I'm sure they had electric there as well. Now, both of these houses in Calvus that was joined to the electric supply were still heated with the fire in the middle of the floor, both of them. And that was in 1950. So you see, you don't need to be all that old to remember some of these things. Tilly lamp, vaporizing lamp. Now I leave it to you to figure out how the electric supply transformed the whole domestic scene. Indeed, more than the domestic scene, for the first time ever, industry could come to the rural areas of Lewis, and I think you should give some thought to that as well. But in the domestic scene, there was the electric cooker, the washing machine, the freezer, the refrigerator, electric kettle, electric iron, toaster, you name it. And even more since then. And you can well imagine the difference between yourself and your granny. And it opened up, as I said, the rural areas for industry. And there is industry. So I leave that one. That's an easy one. I leave that one to think about. I then go on to the domestic water supply. Well, now we all went to the well with a bucket. We took in a double supply on Saturday. Of course, you didn't go to the well on Sunday. Not in South Lochs, anyhow. I don't know what you did in North Loch. I wouldn't trust you. Some of the villages, including ours, has a village well. The water run pretty low in the summertime, it was dry, and most of the small wells dried up. So the congested district board, as a rule, gave them a small grant in order to build a water, to build a village well. And that happened in our village, about the turn of the century, sometime about that. It was about 1970, I think, that the domestic piped water supply, supplied by the local authority, reached the villages in South Loch, and probably the same in North Loch. You may correct 1970, around 1970 sometime anyhow. And most of the houses in the village, in our village, were unfortunately empty by that time. But most of the houses, including some thatched houses, most of the houses were attached to the domestic water supply. Now that opened up quite a field, it opened up bathrooms, toilets, and showers, and the ladies even preferred the water supply to the electric supply, because now you may want to reflect on the situation by 1970. Depopulation had set in. We had two world wars in that century. And herring fishing was down. Herring fishing was finished, actually. Come to that later on. Or we have already referred to one. And a lot of the people were moved off to the cities, to Glasgow. And the subsistence economy of previous times was never a thing in the past. It was well and truly replaced by a money economy. And people needed a lot of money. And rural Louis were no different to the town of Stromoy and the cities. Another aspect of it was that the people in rural Louis were just as well off as their sisters in Glasgow. They now had the electric supply, they had the water supply, and they had a lot of good houses, and the houses were improving, and the roads were improving, and there's a lot of cars, radios and televisions, and enhanced living conditions. But all that, you see, imposed a strain on the family budget. You can't run all these things without money. As I said already, it's no longer a subsistence economy, it's a money economy. So that meant work. And you couldn't depend on going out with a spade and turning the ground there laboriously, spending weeks turning the ground, and then weeks of the harvesting, and spending almost three quarters of the year, catering for the domestic cow. Well, you see certain people saying that the crofting has changed. What crofting had changed? Everything changed. And crofting had to change along with everything else. Anybody now who wants to make his living with a spade and a croft, he has something wrong with his head. No, that passed on. When you're talking about social changes, that's one of the social changes that we have all seen, and even you have yourself seen some of it. And it all happened since the end of the Second World War. Nothing wrong with crofting. That has nothing to do with crofting. Crofting has changed. It has changed from turning the ground with a spade in lots, which was even at the best of times not very profitable. But it was no longer profitable after the Second World War. And crofting went over to stock and sheep, whether it was cows, they were bred for meat and for followers. But most of the people went over to sheep. Now, I was talking about water, or I wandered on to... But you see, all these things are interconnected. Not departmentalized. You talk about water, you talk about electricity, you talk about crafting, you talk about... The whole thing knits together. So, we leave that to you. get it together. Now, I'm going to say a few words now on roads before I take a break. Now, I don't know when roads when the roads were laid into but I have a note. I'll make a note of it soon, but I have a note of the date when the first road was commenced in Stornoway on the way to Harris. I think that's probably, it's either at the end of the 18th century or the beginning of the 19th century, but I'll find a deal for that for you. And that road took a long time before it reached even Ballalla. It stopped at Sorwell, here. And I suppose it was after that that the road, in the 19th century sometime, that the road went into Newbuston and crossed. And perhaps the local people will be able to tell more about that. Now, all these roads, the point I want to make to you about these roads, all these roads in the earlier times were made with free labour, a lot of free labour. In fact, the free labour element in the early roads here under the Ross and Cromarty County Council extended from a quarter to three quarters. So, I don't know if I have an answer in the bottom of my hand just now. Yes, I have. I have here for South lots small grants that they got from the Congested District Board. Take for instance 93-94, that was free rather, you know, 75% free labour. And that was from Arvik to Calvast. And then in 96-97, one in Limerway, 75% free labour again. And that grant was only £106. So I have in the 93-94 year, I'm back to it again, the roads in Calvus, Graver, Cashatter, Cromore, Kerrivard and Lemroy. All of them extending from 1,000 yards to down to 560. And all of them done with 75% free labour. And then in the following year or two, 96-97, Lemroy, Graver, Merivale, Cromore, Cashatter and Kerrivard and Harvest again. All 75%. And then in 96-97, again, this time with only a 33 and a third free labour, one third. And that was Cashatter, Harvest, Limerick, Graver, and Marwick, and Cromore. And I am sure that it was about that time that you also were there with them as well, and probably under the same system. But the point I want to make as far as you are concerned here, that the earlier roads was just a few stones and a little gravel spread on top of the peat. And people using a wheelbarrow and a handbarrow and hessian backs to cart the material to make the surface of the road. You laid some of these roads in order to get the children on to school, because the children didn't have shoes and all that. And you pick a note of any of these things that you wish us to come back on. When you think of it, it was 1928, as I said before, when the road was made round the end of Lochwerisa. Down to the and you must realise that we went from South Lough to Stornoway on a boat before that. Or we crossed Lochwerisa on a postal boat. Be the first, fishing to a shore where the first. The one at Cullamore, a mutty, you don't remember, my yiddick, a geeksack, a carignack, my yiddick. Ach, was in Tracht, will you order me no along once, and the Koshak was torn across the pot. I was a Koshak of Ramore, confession in the first, was in the whole other first. Ach, was in the whole other herrick in a howlock and heen. No Shornwer, on the boat. So, you see, that was a transport on the roads. And most of the notes I have on roads are for South Lough, you don't want too much of that. Some on the other side. You could work was restarted on the Balala and Havas Road in 1922. When I stopped, it was empty. It was stationary for a while. The district committee grant of 38,000. Well, I asked you, how much road would you make with that 38,000 grant nowadays? But a mile of road costs £1.5 million. So that's the way things changed. I should say concerning roads that Lord Leverham after the First World War made a lot of roads too. So in that connection perhaps you could refer to him. He made a lot of roads in the castle grounds as well. And I remember people from Calvert working for him there. But he made a lot of other roads too. So, there you are now. You can leave roads at that. I want to say just one or two words about the Calvost Gravel Road. Now, the Calvost Gravel Road was commenced about 1936 or 7. When I was a big strapping boy, 20 years old, and people came to work on the Calvost Road from as far away as Rornish. I remember one or two Rornish people working on the Calvost Road, and they were staying in an old house in Calvost there. And I just want to illustrate the point here. We worked like navvies on that road. I was at it. Started in 1936. And the method they had then was some sort of piecework. We had to make so much road. So we worked for 6 weeks before we got our first payment. And then a lump sum came from the county council to the gaffer to distribute among us. And do you know this? When the gaffer distributed the money among the workers, the hours, it came to 2.5 old pence. Well, that's a new penny, in the present currency. And that's all we got an hour. And we had made a lot of road. So the whole thing stopped there and then. You see, that road started from the Calvost end towards Graver, and from the Graver end towards Calvost. Maybe you're not used to that area. But you'll have to go around. One of the things that you'll have to do is to familiarize yourself with the geography, as well as the history of your parish. Well, there you are. The thing I have to say about that, 1936-37, Cast your mind back. 1938, the war nearly started. Chamberlain was the president, who was the British Prime Minister at that time, went over to talk to Hitler in Munich, the Munich crisis, as they call it. And he came back with a slip of paper. You sometimes see it on the television. Chamberlain standing in the door of a train with a slip of paper saying, "Peace in our time." So he got off with it in 1938, and the local folk will tell you all about that. Perhaps some of them were called up at that time to go to the review, naval review, that was in the English Channel. Certainly some of us went there. And I donned my naval uniform as a Royal Naval Reservist at that time and came across to Stornoway. But by the time we reached Stornoway, the boat was full. I think it was the Loch Ness. Then again, you're a local people who confirm these things. Well, in the following year, in 1939, the war did start. Where did all the money come from, anyhow? And all the money in the world once the war started. All the money in the world. But they expected us to work on the colonies for 2 pence an hour, penny in the. Oh, and you see, that's it. Jim wrote the heaver of his father be over. So that's all I'm seeing just now. Thank you very much, Chrissy. Well, now, Chrissy, here we are once again. On Friday morning, the 1st of April, 1996. And we have now covered most of the small items. Before we come to one or two of the big items again, we refer to radio and television and life without radio and television might sound strange to young people, to the present generation. And they were both unknown in Lochs in the early part of the 20th century. It was into the 1930s before the first radio set came to Calvost. The radio was the first big intrusion into the privacy of the homes of the people, so perhaps you can comment on that. It brought a different culture to our hearth. And before it was the most, and therefore it was the most serious threat yet to our culture and language. At first, we could and did control it by careful selective use. But unfortunately, that is gone by the board. At first, our radio sets were battery operated because we didn't have the electric supply. So you could perhaps mention that small accumulator, we call them wet battery, like something like a car battery in miniature. We took them to Stornoway for recharging. And because of the trouble we had with the batteries refilling them, we were selective in the use of the radio itself. Then came the electric, and now there are probably several radios in every house, more than one radio in each house. To begin with, there was only one here and there, and people gathered round the radio when it came first in the 30s. I remember when I got a radio, the folk from the house came in to listen to it. And that was particularly so during the war years when they watched the radio. The television wasn't there then, it was just the radio. and became highly popular during the war here. Now, you can get radios with drive batteries, and you know all that. And I'll leave the radio now. You can consult your local folk further, or we can have a discussion about it. We now come to the television. And the television became available in Lewis in the 1960s. And to begin with, it was only available in Stornoway. And by cable, the McKeever and Dart laid a cable. And eventually it became available throughout. And I think what where you're concerned with this thesis of yours is the radio versus our culture. Is our old Celtic culture, language, traditions, and evangelical religion going to be able to withstand the impact of television? And then you could perhaps comment on the impact the radio and the television has had on our way of life already. I think that would be all I would say about television. Now, I think we have touched on most of them. I'll mention two or three here now on which I didn't comment as yet. Bardock and poetry, for instance, I leave that one to yourself. Nicknames, I leave that one to yourself. Skialochan, or local stories, I also leave that one. And Gaelic names of plants, if you manage to find any of that. And old medicines. Of course, new medicines for the present medical situation. I'll go into that later on. And perhaps the working of the craft, we'll see what we'll see about that. Emigration, I leave that one to yourself. And perhaps aspects of our local way of life, entertainment, for instance, entertainment of the young, dance of roads included, and all that. I'll leave all these for the time being to yourself. And then I will list the ones, the bigger questions that we would like to go into yet. Perhaps I should leave the Keeley House with you as well, and come to religion, for instance. Religion, education, medical services as they are now, and Harris Tweed, and perhaps working in the craft. There are four or five bigger aspects there. I might have something written on these things. I'll have a look and give you a read of them. Now, I feel, Chrissy, I feel that all these things are very good to go over them and note them, but it is our heritage, our language, our culture that I would think needs comment. Our spiritual heritage, you know, the word religion takes in the whole thing, but the practical spiritual heritage as we know it locally. And our doctor, church people are there. These are the things that have real value. Of culture in its various forms, including religion. And a discussion on that group of people would be very nice, I'm sure. Now, to sum up, I look at my list, and I have the following half a dozen headings yet. Religion, social change, Leverium, medical services, Harris Tweed, craft work, and heritage. So we might touch on these yet, and then give you a rest. I don't know how much you want to say about medical services. In the passing, I'm sure you could compare the past to the present anyhow, and that itself would be very interesting. In the 1840s, there were only two doctors in Louis in the 1840s, Dr. Miller and Dr. McKeever, and they were both based in Stornoway. So there you are, there wasn't a doctor in the whole area of Louis. These two doctors served the whole island, although in theory, even at that time, there should have been a doctor in each of the four parishes. In fact, for a while, Dr. Miller, who was the son of a prosperous Glasgow merchant, was the only doctor in Louis. Dr. Roderick Ross, who was the son of Alan Ross of Crabbeck, one of these Crabbeck Rosses again, became the first doctor in the parish of Loughs in 1875. He practiced from Crabbeck itself from 1875 to 1879 and from Stornoway from 1879 to 1882. He then moved to Walters in Loughs. That is on the shores of Loch Erisoch, from where his mother came from. That in Walters, his mother was from. And there, he was there from 1882 to 1884. And then he moved to Ball in Louis, Ball Ness in Louis. Dr. Dugald Sinclair was in Loughs from 1885 to 1888. He practiced from Cures. And he lived in Cure's schoolhouse, along with schoolmaster, Mr. Crawford. He was an Argyllshire man, and the salary for the post was £150. In addition to what he could make from private practice. Well, this doctor lived to the ripe old age of 100 years later on. The next Loughs doctor was a man from Uist, pardon me, Dr. Angus Macaulay. He was there from 1889 to 1895, and he was the first doctor to occupy the purpose-built doctor house in Cures. Perhaps you won't remember that the doctor was in Cures. During my earlier days, there was no other doctor in Loughs but the one doctor in Cures, and he did the whole of Loughs, right down to Grimshither and right down to Valamis in southern Park. Now, he was, as I said, Dr. Angus Macaulay was the first doctor in the purpose-built house. The purpose-built house is still in Cures there. Before then, Reverend Ewan Campbell, 1870 to 1888, the second the second parish minister at Cowes, after the upheaval of the disruption, extended his 1,200-acre glebe and demolished the old parish school. So I think we'll leave the parish school and say a word about education. The old parish school was the only school in the parish again. Now, Dr. Macaulay, which I mentioned, New Eastman, his daughter was married to Reverend Donald McCallum, another parish minister at Cowes. He was there from 1889 to 1921. He was there a long time. And he was well known in the land question. He was a leading land the previous Crofter Union. Now, after Donald Macaulay, Dr. Donald Macaulay was in Cowes from 1889 to 1895, and after him, Dr. Donald MacNaughton, from 1895 to 1900. Then came Dr. Hugh Mackay, 1900 to 1901, followed by Dr. Henry G. Mahon, M-A-H-O-N, 1901. He was only there shortly, 1901. He died suddenly in Lacte. And Dr. Alan Cameron, a native of Lochaber, came in 1902. Now, the older folk will have perhaps know all about Dr. Cameron. I remember hearing a lot about him when we were young. While he was there, he came there in 1902, and he was there till 1920. Well, by that time I was 4 years old. It is said that he was the first owner of a car in Loss, a Model T Ford, in 1917. So there's a point for you. First car in Loss, 1917, by the doctor. Now, second side of this tape, and as we were saying, Dr. Alan Cameron of Lochaber came to Loss in Cowes in 1902 up to 1920, followed by Dr. Donald Campbell, a man from Ness, from 1920 until the Cowes practice was closed in 1939. Having been split into two practices, that of North Loss and South Loss. So the South Loss practice, with Dr. Hector MacDonald, a man from Stornoway, the associations with Crossbow, the South Loss practice was opened in 1936. Now you will recall, perhaps you will remember even, that Dr. Hector MacDonald came from Graver to Lurepost, because the practice, the North Loss side of the practice, moved from Cowes to Lurepost, where it is now. And the first doctor there was Dr. Donald Campbell of Ness, who came up from Cowes. So there you are. I leave these. You could follow these if you like, right through. But that's an idea of the medical, the doctor side of the medical service, anyhow. And I want to mention a very important thing here. Nursing, perhaps nursing with you, is even more interesting. And incidentally, on the news yesterday, there was the fuss about calling the GPs, the doctors, out at night, and
They're thinking of stopping that, trying to slow it down anyhow.
Well, can you imagine one doctor in Kyoz attending to everybody from Grimshadr to the park, to Southern Park, day and night? And not only that, but you had to walk for the medicine. We had to come from Calvos, and I personally did come from Calvos after our doctor's visit. There was no telephones, you see. After a doctor's visit, we came to Kyoz. We rode across Loch Erythr to Kyoz to get a bottle of brown cough mixture, brown medicine. It was always a bottle, never pills. And, well, these are things you could discuss locally. My purpose here is to stimulate your mind to discussion. But we came a long way in the 20th century, and that is, unless I said it before, we have seen more changes in the 20th century than all the centuries before put together, and that in all aspects of life. But I want to come to the nursing things. Before I come to nursing, perhaps I should, while I'm talking about doctors, I should say that the only medical services available to the early settlers in Loughs was their own traditional cures. The 19th century, most of the 19th century, as I said before, there wasn't professional doctors. See, my father's, grandfather's generation, they had their own cures. Conky and douche. They were naturally knowledgeable in medicine and medication and traditional home cures and herbal medicine. And there was yeast among them, you know. Some of them specialized in certain branches of medicine. For instance, some were experts in bone setting. And indeed there was. I saw some of them pretty good at that. In both man and beast. I know people that was very good at setting bones. Then there was bloodletting. There was a lot of bloodletting. You see, they lanced the arteries. And, well, they believed a lot in that. Too much blood in you. Our poor present weak generation haven't got enough of it. However, anyhow, there was bloodletting. It applied to a wide variety of ailments, and professional medical people frown on it. Oh, well, they frown on a lot of old things as well. Nevertheless, it would probably lower the temperature in certain cases at least, and probably the blood pressure as well, probably lower the blood pressure, and who knows what else. Well, I leave that by just mentioning it, it's for you to find out. You couldn't reach for the phone in these days and get the doctor in at any time of the day or night. You had to be able to do something. Colds and symptoms like that. Well, it was hot drinks. And indeed, a lot of people believe in hot drinks yet. Jochfan, what we called it, and I remember a bowl of Jochfan beside the fire. You see, you made it with oatmeal and very little salt or no salt at all, and a bit of butter, and you made it
fluidy in such a way that you would drink it, not a sort of porridge at all. Faced it with butter and a good measure of whiskey if it was around. Allowed to stand next to the open fire so that it might be taken from time to time. Now, if you caught your cold early and took a dose of Jofran, you sweated after it and you were all right in the morning. The patient was kept warm in bed, as I reason, and there it was. And there was poultice. We used poultice, foolish. Also made with oatmeal. Oh boy, oatmeal was used for a lot of things, for man and beast. And it's pretty good, apart from porridge. It's used for a lot of other things as well. Anyhow, poultice. And you local people will tell you why that was used for. Other medical practitioners, as I would call them, specialized in counting away the stye on the eye, down again at the hood. And the writer recalls undergoing that treatment successfully twice. There you are. From different ladies, two ladies in the village. And the stye on the eye promptly disappeared as well. Looking back, you wouldn't think much of it, but, we had confidence in these things, and I don't know how much that had to do with it. I remember one of the ladies, and indeed she was from Ranish, Medina, and the next crop to me, Ben Elan Vrohi. She counted my Yavnagan away with Kuran, you know, Gana Tree Kuran. Small pieces of peat, up to 10, and she counted up to 10 and back down to naught. It in a hand gonna gas, it na gas gonna trees, it and three gonna case, it is gonna pour and onward. It in dish gonna different care after that fashion. Still remember that. Noon, Konega, it's a kind old lady who moved one coon and at a time, you know, from one place to another. The indisputable proof of the treatment was that was the success that all was followed, whether by faith or otherwise. Well, that was one kind of specialism. We had two of them in common. Another group of specialists was those who were born feet first. They specialized in spinal disorders. What they call nowadays slip disc. One of my school pals, one of my best school pals, Next Croft was one of these. I'm not going to mention his name. We called him the doctor. The treatment was affected by the patient lying flat, face down on the floor, and the yeesh, which was usually a young person, stepped gently on the affected part of the back, moving his feet, shoes taken off, of course, moving his feet back and forth. So probably what happened is inadvertently they slipped these discs into the right position again. I don't know. Later on, my school friend elevated to specialize in spiritual healing. He was a gospel preacher, a good gospel preacher. We had a lot of them in Carlisle. Now, yet another group of exclusive specialists practiced the cure of King's Evil, Jinsri, a form of boil. Their qualification were to be born as the seventh consecutive boy or the seventh consecutive girl. in any one family. So there's little hope of having any more of these. There's nobody going to have seven of anything now, consecutive or otherwise. However, there was plenty of sevens and tens in our day. The treatment of this complaint was to obtain a bottle of water in which the Li dipped or washed his or her hands and apply the water gently to the affected part over a period of days until it began to go down and disappear. And disappear it did, I can tell you. And I remember going to Morgan Man, incidentally, was Morgan Man, you know, was one of these. And I remember myself going to Cremorne, and the girl is still living in Cremorne, getting a bottle of water from her hands. I think it was from my father. Then, of course, the thing I really want to come to is the confinements. That's a nursing I was talking about, women's confinements. To begin with, there was no trained nurses, and I think that would be a very interesting aspect of your article, I would think. Up to the beginning of this century, there was no one trained local midwives. The first one that came to South Loch was about the turn of the century. I think as far as I can find out, probably the century had turned. And lone midwife, untrained, there was one at least in each village, as far as I can find out, or more. And I've seen it written in more than one place, whatever credibility that's in it. I've seen it written that death. Rate of children death rate, what do you call it, was lower in these islands than anywhere in Europe in these days. I don't know if that's scientific, anybody calculated that. But the death rate wasn't all that high, and it wasn't any higher than other places anyway, you may be sure. And in any case, the survival rate was high, very high. All these people, you can imagine, in the 19th century, when that population explosion took place, and these Bengals, with no facilities whatsoever. I remember Dr. Macaulay from Stornoway, Dr. Macaulay from Crossbows, I remember him commenting on that. And he was knowledgeable in that, so I didn't have an interview with him. There was one in our village, and I remember her quite well. The last one, at that time she was out of work. Mother and methods. Made her redundant, as you see now. However, when I was poking around finding these things out, I was told that Bentra de Rue, the one I'm talking about in Calvus, Bentra de Rue, 1853 to 1940, she took a lot of children, and she dealt with her own daughter. Now, as I said, Bentra de Rue's daughter, Mechelen and Gladi, she had five children, and it was her mother that attended to them all. And she was still taking children into the early 1920s. Of course, the other four, nurses were around. Oh, people didn't trust the professional nurses all that much. They trusted the old ones. Well, Magdalene's first child, she walked 5 miles in the morning of a Sunday morning. As usual, we always walked, and I walked. There was no road from Grammar to Calvert. We walked to Grammar. She walked to Grammar, to the church in the morning. And later on that day, she got a child. Posty Bell, she's still living. She turned me from last week. And there you are. That's what I think people did. Now, nursing stations were set up again. Nursing station, the district of Grammar, I think it was 1924. And Guinevard, about the same time, mid-1920s, shall I say. And then there was one in Balalan and one in Crossapos. So probably, you could check, probably they were set up at the same time, in 1920s. So you see, there isn't all that wrong since then. Your grandmother will tell you all about that. Now, I can give you a list of the district midwives that served in the Grammar and Road district. But I don't think you need to bother about these small details. There was Nurse MacLeod from Oog, 1902. Nurse MacDonald from Oog, 1908. Nurse McCree from Stornoway, 1904. Nurse Martin from Oog was then, I haven't got the date. Nurse Macaulay from Oog again, seemed quite good at nursing in Oog, 1929. Nurse Fletcher from Skye, 1932, I remember her quite well. And then a whole lot of nurses in my time. Nurse MacDonald from Oog, Mackay from Barras, Keever from Oog again. Most of these got husbands in South Ross. And by that time, fair sex was getting scarce down there, so they dropped and that came. Nurse McKeever back, well, there you are, she's married in Marivik. Nurse MacDonald, half of Loth. Nurse MacLeod, Guinevard. Nurse McCush from Harith. And Nurse McKenzie. Married. She was from Bath, she's still there, married in Mary. So, it's a broad outline, I'm sure, that you're aiming at all the small details. And then there was the hospital facilities, and that itself is very interesting. Well, you know, we have a huge, big, modern hospital in Stornoway now. Young people like yourself may think that that's how the things were from the beginning of the world. No, we only have hospitals about 100 years ago. So before that, there was no hospital. Not in Louis. Some in Glasgow, an occasional person went out to Glasgow. The Louise Hospital, or that's the one that's now pulled down, opened for patients in 1896. They give us 100 years ago. The need for a hospital was obvious, and a public meeting was convened in Stornoway in 1892, and a committee was formed consisting initially of all the medical practitioners in the island, the ministers of all denominations, and the resident sheriff and chief magistrate of Stornoway, etc. A subscription list was opened, and a site for a hospital was obtained from Lady Matheson, who was the proprietress at that time. Plans were prepared for a stone and lime building with slated roof. And that's, I don't know that it isn't up yet, I think, I am inclined to think that part of it was left. That was the part in the middle. And provision for 12 beds at an estimated cost of about 2,000. Well, imagine that, 2,000. What did the new hospital cost? Well, there you are. In 1894, work was commenced on the building work, even though the committee had not yet collected the full sum of 2,000. The committee had an eye to the future because their building plans provided for a building that was capable of easy extension. Money was scarce, of course. Overheads had to be kept to the minimum, and therefore the nursing staff consisted, and listen to this, the nursing staff consisted of the district nurse and the town's Bible woman. So that was all the staff they had, and they were already paid for what they were doing. Where they were located at the hospital, and they were to continue exercising their functions in what they were already engaged, as well as the general caretaking of the hospital and nursing of its inmates at an annual salary of £30 each. The new hospital relied entirely on voluntary contributions, and it was not until 1925 that the first full-time surgeon, Dr. J. E. Purvis, P-U-R-V-I-S, was appointed. Before that, Dr. Murdoch Mackenzie Stornoway acted, that's the GP, acted as a part-time surgeon. A few bedded maternity units was added to the hospital in 1929. So there you are, a maternity unit wasn't established in Lewiston until 1929. Through the generosity of T.B. Macaulay. Well, there used to be a plaque up in the old hospital, probably they carried it over to the new hospital. T.B. Macaulay was of Montreal, was a Lewisman of Whig extraction. Then the hospital continued to expand, and eventually it came under the National Health Service. It was replaced by a large new purpose-built hospital in September 1992 with 200 beds. We cannot talk about medical things without talking about tuberculosis, a very, very important aspect of our local history. There was a time when there was no tuberculosis in Lewis, and there are speculations of where it came from. It was felt that people took it home from Glasgow, the slums of Glasgow. And the housing here was not the kind of thing that could stand up to that unknown disease spread through ignorance more than anything else. Changes kept tuberculosis. It was the greatest killer disease. I don't know whether that has been superseded with the present day killer. It is said that it was not known in the island until about 1870, and it wrought havoc in the overcrowding housing conditions in Lewis once it came. Ignorance of the real nature of the disease and a complete absence of simple precautions ensured the rapid spread of the disease. Once a member of the family contracted it, there was no escaping because they were sleeping close to each other. There was also the stigma. You see, perhaps that was the worst of all. Stigma. There's still stigma of various things going on today, unfortunately. Well, the stigma of having tuberculosis, okay? Well, few or nobody survived. Perhaps I was the first person And I know that's all right.
Yeah.
Because I got treatment in Glasgow. Now, I remember Dr. Doig, the medical officer of health for Lewes, stating in 1963, I think it was, that the victims throughout Lewes were mainly young people between 15 and 35 years of age. When we came to live in Marybank and set up the shop, there was scores and scores of people in a sanatorium or county hospital walking up the road to our shop at that time. And then they found treatments and TB was mastered. So perhaps, make a reference to these things if you feel that, without going into it too deeply. Coming back now, I'm sorry the way this is, interruptions here. Coming back now, once again, to religion, and I'm not going to say too much about Ilan Khalamgiri. I think we touched on it before. There are various evidences of that religious self around Cromwell. And if you wish, we could discuss that sometime. But we move on. The Scottish Reformation, which you are well informed, I'm sure, 1560. And it didn't influence, to begin with, for quite some time, it didn't influence religion here. It was not until the whole district of the outer Hebrides from the butt of Lewes to Barra Head was severed from the Presbytery of Skye by the General Assembly of 1824. So you see, we were attached to Skye at one time. And that the first, it was only then that the first Presbyterian church was established in Lochs in 1824. It was sited at the head of Swordle Bay near Cowes, 12 board lops at Crossbus there. And I'm sure the whole home there are. It was a thatched church and manse. And it remained in use until the new slated church at Cowes was built. Well, I think we mentioned that once before. And the manse in Cowes. And the first minister there was Colin Mackenzie, 1724 to 1759, followed by Alexander Mackay, 1760-67, followed by James Wilson, 1768 to 84, and then John Fraser, if you put Reverend before all these people, 1784 to 1792. And the famous Alexander, Reverend Alexander Simpson, 93 to 1831, from 1793 to 1831. And then Robert Finlayson from 1831 to 1843. And that is the same Robert Finlayson that came down to Crossbus at the disruption. So there it was, that was the church there. The first Presbyterian Church of Law, and then which one to the present setup, more or less. The thing about the church history in Lewes, the sad thing about church history in Lewes, is the many denominations and many congregations that spring up from time to time. Somebody starts an argument with somebody else and he gets a few followers and they set up a new denomination. It's a crying scandal. And perhaps I should give you an outline. I don't know if you have studied these things. The disruption was in 1843, as we said. and the church came down in trouble. And nobody left. The whole of the congregation followed Trevor and Robert Finlayson to Crossbus. In fact, they had to import a congregation in order to set up, in order to put another minister in cause. And Reverend Roderick Reed was placed in cause in 1844, year after the destruction. Reverend Ewan Campbell in 1870, and Reverend Donald McCallum, that's a well-known minister from Argyle, 1889 to 1921. And then the last of them in cause was Duncan Matheson, a man from Graver. And he moved to Oog in 1928, or 1928-29. You see, there was a nun again, uniting in the Church of Scotland. And Reverend Duncan Matheson, what happened there is there was money attached to the church, of course, and they moved the whole congregation over to Beanrigg. And the Beanrigg congregation, as I'm talking about Beanrigg Lewis just now, the Beanrigg congregation, Church of Scotland congregation, is in Beanrigg, is called the Lochs congregation in Oog, because it's a continuation of the Cowes thing, because they wanted to get their hands on the money that was attached to that establishment. So that's that now. Now, coming back to the new congregation at Crossbus, you see, and Crossbus itself was new. The whole thing was new. You note that Crossbus was only established that very year, 1843. And the other thing to be noted about that, about the religious history at that time, is that the Lochs parish extended over to include Carloway and Carloway area. At that time in Lochs. So the original Free Church congregation at Crossbus therefore began to splinter from the very outset. The people of the west side of the island in the Calway area left the Crossbus congregation and formed a Free Church congregation of their own in 1884, the very year after. And in 1894, the people of Shawbus left Calway. Well, perhaps these things, there's a lot of people over there, that these splits were reasonable enough. For about another 30 years, the people of Park walked up to 6 miles. Some of them were away up to Denver, further out than Denver, and then crossed the loch and all that. So the people of South Lochs, it's a reasonable thing for them to get a congregation. And they used to meet outside, actually, on the south of Lochs at that time. Sometimes in character, perhaps, when they came across the Loch, after services there. So there is something to be said, you see, for breaking up the single congregation. Covering the whole parish. But the thing about that is that none of these things can be done reasonably. I'm introducing a lot of politics into these things, so you disregard politics. You don't present politics there. I'm telling you, this is the story as I see. While church politics and national now, the reasonable proposition to form a new congregation in the South of Lochs generated a lot of lively discussion. You see, that's how we are. We start arguing about everything. The Crossbus Kirk session, led by the minister, opposed the breaking up of the Lochs congregation at first. See, that's all ministers. You watch them. They don't want to break up the reasonable proposition. then there were various elements on the South side arguing about where the site of the proposed new church. Well, that's the next thing, you see. We keep arguing about where to put it. The smallest thing we keep arguing, particularly in religion. Heated debates. And, strangely, some of the people wanted to put it in Columbus. Some of them wanted to put it in Caverstein. I got the lowdown on a meeting they had. A man from Warwick was there as well, tell you his name. The delegation came across to a meeting in Carmel. They were met by the minister, Reverend Hector Cameron, and the Kishta Moore, Mother MacLeod, the Kishta Moore from Louisville. He was a man that went across to Louisville from Cashelburg. He belongs to the MacLeod of Cashelburg, actually. And he was a leading man, of course, he was an able man in the Kishta from Louisville. And they had with them Alice MacCaramet from Bramish. Alice MacCaramet, I'm sure. So the Kishta from Louisville, being a bard, of course, he could, unfortunately, there isn't very much of the bard left. They've got snippets of an old man in Lenore at one time. Hashing la halap was the human kun. Mithain, Ugus, Yachin, Cameron, Ugus, Alzma, Caramon. Kudu, skippled Anna. Hogy volt őt bőrön vánca, hogy dönnyit ott már hórs, amarád fejt, egy csinál a lóly, és szanta jöri a hocsúrt, bőn a frissát a bőrútól ván a lakmik, mondjit hramód, és kódgáv csillő, mondjit gyere várt, vi var nära vi. Ach, kärsa, när du stav oss. Det är genom brev och gräs och biskup bra, eller biskup mig bra, från allt där det är kyl. Och droppar in i sida här, vad sen sagt, att det är så att vi inte har stått här på det. Det är under precis vi kan ha. In any case, I don't think they were pressing. They didn't come into the congregation. Ultimately, the congregation was based on gravity. And Kershaw and Habit went to King Law. So, it's a pity we didn't have these things. Very interesting. Bardock and all sorts of things that's being lost. So you make sure that you won't lose anything more. Well, however, that's a Kishta. They lived in 51 in Boston. And now, up to the time of the formation of the Grammar Church, the Grammar Pat Congregation, were four ministers at Cross Buzzards, Robert Finlayson, 1843-56, and then John McRae, MacRamore, 57-64, George L. Campbell from 65-75, and Hector Cameron, 76-81. And he is the one that was involved in this. Now, it was customary for the Crossbus minister to hold a rigid meeting in the outlying part of the scattered district from time to time. On one such occasion, he announced his intention to hold a meeting at Gower. And as usual, the Gravett people were meant to call for him at Crossfield. And at that time, you didn't have a car or a road, so you came around with a boat with a sail because you didn't have a motor either. And the weather was favourable in the morning, and after delivering a memorable sermon at Gravett as usual, he was a good preacher. Preparations were made for the return journey to Crossfield, and the experienced fishermen over there, you see, they were used to assessing the weather, and they knew it was pretty rough outside, but the landlubber minister didn't realize that. So, however, they set off, and they said to themselves, "We'll teach you a lesson this time." So they got him out there into the rough weather, you see. And when you handle a sailboat, you can handle it reasonably, and you can handle it roughly too. So these boys had handled it pretty roughly by the pool of gravel. And the Reverend gentleman was soaking wet, you see. And they taught him the hazards of sea journeys, crossing the sea to get to church. Easy. And they deliberately handled the sailboat in such a way as to make the worst of what was fairly stormy weather anyhow. The poor minister was not used to the sea, was soaked to the skin with sea spray and scared out of his wits. He pleaded repeatedly to the men to turn back or take shelter in one of the other paddles, such as Marrick and Cremona, etc. But they stubbornly refused, saying that they would carry out their mission and land the minister safely and prosperous. Well, they knew what they were doing all right. If it was God's will of God. however, for the minister it was a severe test of faith, and from that day on it was more amenable to the folk from the South Loch. In any case, in 1879, the following people signed the schedule for a new congregation. Limberway, approximately 145 people. Gravett, 232 people. Calvert, 112 people. And Marrick, 158 people. A total of 647 people. Variously given as 644 or 647, so approximately that anyway. And you can see that there's a lot of people over there, and it was a reasonable thing to give them a congregation. All of these people were over 14 years of age, and they promised to raise a sustentation fund contribution of £88 a year. So that would cover the price of the minister, so on. They eventually agreed to build a church in Gravett, which of course was a proper place of the middle of the district. The village of Cremona didn't come into it to begin with. Oh, you see, they, well, that's religion. They remained in Crossbus. Well, of course, they ran across the box of houses there. Crossbus was beside them. And then, about 1900, Cremona remained in a crossroads until about 1900. And the village of Derivard didn't come into Gravett either. The first day went along with the Kinloch one. So there you are now, the Kinloch one. They formed a congregation in 1885, some 10 years from the village, from the head of the north. And that consisted of 600 people. And they promised a sustentation of £94 a eventually the villages of Penrodder to go to Gran. The first minister in Gran was Neil M. Morrison, 1868, and Hector Kennedy from 1985 to 107.